Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. We're back for another episode on a very cold January 8th, 2015. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
Is it cold where you are too, Ray?
39, which for here is pretty cold.
Yeah, well, it's not going to be as cold tonight as it was last night.
Right.
Boy, here where I'm at, last night was really freezing, and it's going to come back again like that tomorrow night. So we're in, of course, it's January. What do you expect in January?
There you go.
It must be below zero up north.
Well, oh, yeah, in a lot of the country it is.
Yeah, I haven't even looked around the rest of the country. I've been in kind of a brain fog here lately. I don't know. I feel like I'm in a little bit of a fog, but at the same time, I feel very peaceful and fine. I want to say that this is episode 41, and do you have any opening remarks about tonight's show, Ray?
You know, there were two or three simple but very profound statements made through tonight's section by Hitler that, to me, are so hit home as far as the America and the Republic that it was supposed to be. Very simple thing.
I've got one like that, too, so it might be the same one.
Yeah, I think two or three of them reminded me of that, but I'm glad you picked up on that, too.
Yeah. Well, and maybe we'll wait and wait till we get to them mention them now. So,
sure.
Okay. We're starting on the 22nd of June, correct?
Yes, and if I'm not mistaken, that's the one-year anniversary of Barbarossa,
the attack
on Russia, which was June 22nd, 1941. It's the war on the Eastern Front's been going on for exactly a year.
Okay, good comment. Well, a timeline for the 9th of June, which somehow we stopped on the 8th, and so, but I thought this one was kind of important, so I thought I'd mention it. On the 9th was the day that the Nazis, says here the Nazis, of course, the National Socialists, burned the Czech village of Lidice as a reprisal for the killing of Reinhard Heydrich. And they say that all male adults and children are killed, but that's not true. Because there was an age limit for the males 16 and older. And males who are younger than 16, even if you're, I suppose, 15 one day from 16, that you went with the females. And the females were taken off to concentration camps. But I've read different accounts of this. There's, you know, they try to make it out to sound as bad as possible. But if you know what the Germans did was to make the men responsible and execute the men, but they never executed the women, unless it was individual women who were found guilty of treason or found guilty of engaging in the in what these men were doing and so on. And the reason they picked out then they did, which they should have done.
Yeah.
And the reason they picked out this village is because it was discovered that these people responsible for killing Heydrich were hidden there for a while, and also the whole village knew about it and were engaged in partisan activity more than some others, and so they picked out that village to be the one that they would punish, and boy, they did a good job of it. They got rid of all the inhabitants, and they raised the all the buildings. It wasn't very many. I mean, it wasn't a big place or anything. So they could have done a lot worse, but they did this to make a statement. And of course, they're castigated ever since, and it's made out to be one of these horrible, horrible atrocities. Not mentioning the whole cities that they leveled in Germany, the British. Royal Air Force, so it's just kind of crazy. But everything that happened in Germany, they deserved, and what happened to other people, they didn't deserve at all. That's the way it goes. Well, that's not our topic tonight. That's just an incidental thing. And I'll go on to another timeline for the 9th was at Bir Hakeim, Rommel renews his attacks on the 1st Free French Brigade's box in quotes. Although the Free French continued to hold out, their perimeter, even so, it's dangerously reduced in size, and their position becomes untenable. Leave it to the French, huh? And General Ritchie orders the 1st Free French Brigade to withdraw the following day. So the French are not doing too well there. And then jumping to the 21st, the day before the day we're going to start our reading, the Africa Corps recaptures Tobruk with 35,000 men captured. And the road to Egypt is now open as the British retreat deep into Egypt. Tobruk's loss is a grievous blow to British morale. Do you want to say anything about Tobruk? I was just reading about it before the show started a little bit.
Yeah, mentioned in our readings tonight, particularly talking about Rommel. And that one interesting thing there, what you said, was kind of cleared the road to Egypt. Years ago, I made the acquaintance of an Egyptian who became my friend, and he's a neurosurgeon here where I live. And he told me, when we discussed a lot of this stuff, he said there were very, very many, many people in Egypt anxious to see Germany succeed because they had a hatred for the British. Some of them didn't mind the British, but others really didn't like Britain kind of lording it over the Egyptians or tell them what they could and couldn't do. Their presence there more than anything else. And they felt that Germany had the more righteous cause in the war. And a lot of them, including him, thought that Germany would win that war. But it's just interesting.
Yeah, well, of course, a lot of people thought that. Now, I was reading about that, and Tobruk once belonged to the Italians. And they lost it to the British. You know, and then they called on the Germans. And the Germans had to come, or did come, and under Rommel, they got it back again. But then it was lost again later on. So,
right.
But, you know, I sometimes wonder if the Italians ever won a battle. I shouldn't be so mean. But it's not mean. I mean, really, I do. They had some, I suppose, everything that they, well, that happens to everybody, but. You know, it's just amazing how they get into things, but then they can't get out of it, or they can't succeed at it.
Yeah, their fighting prowess certainly didn't harken back to the ancient days of Rome, that's for sure, and the legions.
No. No, they were under a different kind of philosophy and system. Okay, well, I'm done with that now, so you can get started, Ray.
Okay. 22nd June 1942, midday. Popularity of Rommel and Dedel. Fine British publicity for Rommel. Motorized warfare in the desert. The triumph of the Volkswagen. Dr. Goebbels turned the conversation to the subject of General Rommel. He stated that generals like Brauchitsch, Rundstedt, and others were far from enjoying a popularity comparable to that of Rommel or Dedel. If the press were suddenly to stop writing about men like Brauchitsch and Rundstedt, the public would soon forget all about them. Rommel and Dedel, on the other hand, stood so high in popular esteem that their names had become the personification of German military virtues. And this applied even more, perhaps, to Rommel than to Dedel. The Führer expressed himself as follows. Dedel is popular not only here at home, but also in Finland. As for Rommel, there are two main reasons which explain why he is the leader of public interest in Germany. A, the majority of our people now understand enough about the background of this war to rejoice greatly over every individual victory over Britain. B, the British themselves, as Dr. Goebbels rightly says, have given Rommel enormous publicity because by writing up his exceptional military capabilities, They hoped to make more palatable to their own people the defeats suffered at his hands. Rommel's efficiency, of course, is unquestionable. From the very beginning of the present offensive, he foretold with almost photographic accuracy the advance to the coast and the attack on Tobruk. He then added that the British would certainly fall into the trap he had prepared for them and would occupy a triangle which seemed to them to be a favorable position, but in reality was commanded by a German flak fire and would be shot to pieces. Rommel's victories, moreover, have been made possible by our timely recognition of the fact that desert warfare is a battle of machines. The enemy, on the other hand, had a completely wrong conception of desert warfare because they had arrived at completely wrong conclusions about the capabilities of motor vehicles in the desert. How often in the history of war has some general staff officer or other, unhindered by any practical experience, developed the thesis that motor vehicles in the desert can operate only along the highways? And how often has this thesis been hailed as axiomatic? It has always been my wont to insist that theoretical theses of this sort must be tested practically, and it was on these grounds that I ordered the construction of the Volkswagen. And it was this same Volkswagen which is now giving so magnificent an account of itself in the desert that convinced me of the futility of this particular thesis. The Volkswagen, and I think our war experiences justify us in saying so, is the car of the future. One had only to see the way in which these Volkswagen, roaring up the Obersalzberg, overtook and skipped like mountain goats around my great Mercedes, to be tremendously impressed. After the war, when all the modifications dictated by war experience have been incorporated in it, the Volkswagen will become the car par excellence for the whole of Europe, particularly in view of the fact that it is air-cooled and so unaffected by any winter conditions. I should not be surprised to see an annual output reach anything from 1 million to 1.5 million.
Hmm.
Oh, interesting.
Well, yes, let's discuss this, and then I've got something to bring up that I forgot to bring up in the beginning, that some mail I got from a listener. So Joseph Goebbels was there at this dinner, as he tells us.
Yes.
And so they're talking, of course, about what's going on in the desert and praising Rommel and also Diedel. Hitler just never got over being so grateful to Diedel and so impressed by what he accomplished in Norway. He's the one who really won the battle of Narvik that was so, so very vital in 1940 for the Western campaign. So they bring him up again here. I like that he's promoting the Volkswagen. You know, I need to get another car. I'm slow to do it, but I will eventually, maybe in the coming year. And this caused me to think, maybe I should look at the Volkswagens. I'd like to have a Volkswagen. There's some, but I don't know how they're rated right now at this time in, in 2015, I mean.
Well, I can tell you that. They're very highly rated.
Well, that's good. I'm going to...
Yeah, my daughter owns one, mm-hmm. and I can't remember if it's her second Volkswagen or not, but it has been extremely reliable. She's always singing the praises of that vehicle. So,
how old is hers?
The one she has now is about 3. She's had it about 3 years.
She got it new.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, I wouldn't be doing that, but still, I might look into that. So, all right, and then something I thought was interesting. His method of speaking, he's always so tongue-in-cheek. He says, how often in the history of war has some general staff officer or other, unhindered by any practical experience, how he puts it that way, developed the thesis that the motor vehicles can only operate on the highway? Well, then... In the same way, he said, it's always been my want to insists that theoretical theses of this sort must be tested practically. There again comes up the practical mindedness of Hitler, who doesn't go for just theories and hypotheses and so on. He wants to see how things work out in real life. You know, he's very much about real life. I appreciate that in him. Okay, well, Ray, you know, I got some mail from an anonymous listener who doesn't want to give his name anywhere, so I don't know. I don't have a name for him. But he said some nice things, and including a donation and some material, and he wrote this letter, and he said, thanks so much for all you do. You and Ray are just terrific on HTT, uplifting, entertaining, and suspensefully anticipated all at the same time. I have given myself more than a few chuckles for starting to believe that Hitler spoke with a Texas accent. He puts a smile sign. And far from being in Austria, I now think that Linz was right outside Austin. Then he goes on with some other things. But I thought that was very cute because I've actually thought that myself. I thought, boy, I'm getting used to hearing Ray read as Hitler, and I'm starting to think it can be very comfortable with Hitler's voice sounding just like Ray's and his accent. His accent, too.
That is a wonderful compliment. I really appreciate that, and I hope he's listening tonight. Tell him that it means a lot to me, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, I knew you'd enjoy that. So I saved it to read it here this program.
I was going to comment on that section right there where, at first, you know, I had to look at that. Then I realized what he was talking about, having read somewhat on that North Africa campaign, where he says recognition of the fact that desert warfare is a battle of machines. The enemy, on the other hand, had a completely wrong conception of desert warfare. And what he meant by that was the British did have that feeling that, well, we take our machines out into that desert, and it wasn't just a whole lot of sand dunes by any means. You know, it was small ravines, canyons, things like that. And that the British figured, well, there can't be any fighting out there unless it's troops. We can have troop movements out there to, you know, to cut across here and there. But if we take machines out there, we're going to be involved in delays and breakdowns of equipment, things like this. And so they thought that this campaign is going to be fought near the roads. And whereas Rommel, and like Hitler proudly brags about the Volkswagen being able to handle itself in those conditions in desert warfare, Rommel's tactics, he would go from point A to point B right across that desert if he had to, and through some terrain that was a bit formidable, but his tanks would make it, the jeeps, the half tracks, whereas the British would follow the road, which might be, if Rommel's distance was 5 miles to cover, the British might have to go 15 to reach the same point. And that's what Hitler is alluding to, where he says the desert warfare is a battle of machines, whereas the British thought it was strictly going to be a matter of infantry and combat soldiers. So
anyway. So that was where the British finally learned, didn't they? They made an awful lot of mistakes in the first couple of years.
Right.
And then they started figuring things out. But if they hadn't been pounding Germany with their Air Force the way they did, I don't think they would have come out as well. But they didn't do. They're not the ones who won it anyway. It was when the Americans came in, and then the Russians on the other side. That was just too much.
Yeah.
Well,
that's right.
Okay. So we're going on now to the very next day, the 23rd.
Right. June 23rd, 1942, midday. Minimum restrictions for the people. The fear of the policeman. Black market. Understanding for the peasants. Middlemen. Transportation chaos. Gauleiter Forster said that the cafes in Danzig were literally packed in the afternoons. As they had observed that there were a large number of women, heavily made up and apparently with nothing to do, the police had asked Forster's permission to take these cafes under control. he himself was disinclined to give this permission. The Fuhrer intervened. Quite right. With very few exceptions indeed, everybody in the Reich today has been integrated into the general plan of work, including the women. If the police dog every step of the citizens, we shall turn Germany into a hard labor prison. The duty of the police is to keep the really antisocial elements under surveillance and to render them harmless. But this does not necessitate the surveillance of places of public entertainment. Actually, women who are carrying on relations with some foreigner do not choose a cafe for a rendezvous, but invite them rather to their so-called salons. As for the women who frequent the cafes, they are, for the most part, workers, postal employees, teachers, nurses, and the like, off duty and enjoying a moment of repose. There are also a number of housewives who, deprived of all home life at the moment, but having to work much harder than ever they worked in peacetime, have a right to seek a little distraction. For the rest, if you keep all the somewhat flighty women out of the cafes, the first people to suffer in consequence will be the lads on leave from the front. For goodness sake, don't let us rush to the police every time some small peccadillo raises its head. Let us rather stick to educative measures. Don't forget, after all, that it was not by using fear, inspired by police methods, that we National Socialists won over the people, but rather by trying to show them the light and to educate them. The same principle applies to food control. The professional black marketeer must be pursued and punished with the utmost rigor. But there is no need to stop trains, hold up motor cars, and badger people because they have bought a couple of eggs off the record. And the peasant who, after having fulfilled the obligations put on him, helps a friend out with a bit from his surplus need not have the police put on his tracks. The only effect of that would be to make him eat up all of his surplus himself. Those who took the initiative in causing passengers in trains and cars to be searched ought to remember the conditions which obtain in the North, the land of the big properties. They surely must have forgotten that even in peacetime, the humble peasant woman used to go to the town market to sell a few eggs, a few pounds of butter, things which she thought too precious to be eaten at her own table. No, but if one thinks that this sort of little black market is assuming too large proportions to a point where it may have some influence on prices, then the state must intervene again and buy out of hand, but at prices a little above the official market rates, the entire surplus. In this case, we must act warily, not forgetting that a peasant who has fulfilled the obligations put upon him has the right to dispose of his surplus as he pleases. This encourages him to work harder, and it also helps in consolidating the value of money. Actually, while the peasant tends to hoard, the townsman, on the contrary, tends, particularly in troublesome times, to transform his money into goods. Dr. Goebbels said the Fuhrer's idea of making the state...
Let's stop here. And go over this part since the subject kind of changes. So okay. This came from Forster.
Gauleiter Forster.
And he's been here before, and I had his picture up before, I know that, and he was kind of important in that one where they were talking about the Slavs, because he's there in East Prussia. And, Hitler really liked him, and he was a real good Gauleiter, as you can see from this that's being said right here. But he has a reputation today of being one of the worst of the Nazis, who supposedly is responsible for killing a bunch of Poles or something. And being very anti-Slavic and hating the Poles and all this stuff. But really, he was doing a very good job, and he was right in line with Hitler's way of thinking. So a lot of that has just been drummed up or exaggerated. He was a fairly strict National Socialist, I think. He did right here, too. He said that there was talk that there was too many of these women in the cafes, and the security should control that. And he said, though, that his inclination was to not do that, you know, to leave it alone.
Yes.
And the Fuhrer said, quite right, you know, and yes, and
certainly.
He goes on to explain how he agrees with it. And that again shows what you've said so many times about Hitler being, well, we're going to come into the other part more where Hitler is showing how he doesn't care for too much centralization. But in this case, it's kind of the same thing. It's like, you know, leave people alone. It shows that the security police in Germany and outlying areas and so on were not going around bothering people and arresting people for every little thing, but people were very free to go about their business and do, you know, even with as far as the black market thing, because there was food and price controls and so on, and people had got rationing, ration coupons, and so they not supposed to go beyond their ration coupons, but a lot of people did a lot of things, you know, and as he points out, the peasants, you know, they're the ones who are growing this stuff, and as long as they're supplying what they're asked to, and they've fulfilled the requirements of what is expected of them, what they have left over, they can do with what they want, and they should be allowed to. And this idea that you're going to confiscate everything from them, that so that they don't have anything extra. And I also thought it was very interesting, and I know that here again shows how perceptive Hitler was and how well he knew his people, that said these peasants, they would try to sell on a kind of the black market, sort of. They'd try to sell things like butter that were, as he put it, were too precious to put on their own table.
On their own table.
Yeah. So there they, that kind of catches my heart a little bit, you know. They had all that available to them, but they needed money, too, so they would sell the best of what they had. And then, you know, give it to, allow someone else to have it while they, people who had more money, while they did without. So it's really makes it, that made an impression on me.
Well, you know, and something that, similar that impressed me about this little section right here was the very fact that Hitler is fully aware of the conditions for the civilians back home. You know, you got war going on, so conditions are changed, and there has to be some rationing. There has to be food stamps or whatever they use. And then, of course, the arising of the black market, and it's always things like this. But Hitler's thinking about the civilians and making their way and doing the best they can, and says they don't need harassment from our police. You know, the police, hey, they're supposed to keep an eye on the antisocials and keep them under control and don't mess around with people.
Yeah, and the big criminals.
Yes.
The people who are really doing in the black market. I guess we'll get into some of that here next. But, you know, why bother little people? That's wrong.
And the most, I marked this as a profound statement for me. It hit me when I read it. He's, you know, talked about those women, and he says the first people to suffer if they go to arresting these ladies and keeping them out of there would be the lads on leave from the front. And he says, why should we make a big fuss every time some little thing comes up? And this statement right here, don't forget after all that it was not by using fear inspired by police methods that we National Socialists won over the people, but rather by trying to show them the light and to educate them. Because having been through, you know, with the history instructor that I had, had a class on Nazi Germany, as he called it, and he come up with all of this stuff about the Nazis. We had to read a book by some Jew called The Nazi Seizure of Power, you know, always using those kind of expressions like this, and ignoring the fact that the party came to power by legitimacy, by votes and things like this. So it really it makes me feel good to read these things once in a while, where he says we National Socialists won over the people not by using police state methods or anything like that, but we educated them. And so that was I really liked that.
I noticed that too, Ray, and I had that put in bold, but then I kind of didn't kind of pass by it here. But, I thought that was very telling and important because, again, he has never used those methods and never wanted to try to used terror and things like that, which the National Socialists are accused of. So,
but in any study of National Socialism, it's presented like Orwell's book 1984. That kind of police state stuff, that this is what National Socialist Germany was all about, which is total garbage, Jewish lies, whatever you want to call it, but it's just disgusting because it flies in the face of truth, and you get so tired of hearing that stuff, so it's refreshing to see a statement like that once in a while.
Absolutely.
Dr. Goebbels said the Führer's idea of making the state step in as a subsidiary purchaser was a solution after the manner of Columbus and the egg. When the Führer asked how soon it would be possible to draw up adequate regulations, Bormann replied that the necessary steps had been taken and would come into force very soon, and that a system of price control appropriate to the situation had also been evolved. The Führer continued, "It really is enough to make anyone angry when one thinks that people are being deprived of essential food simply thanks to the pettiness of certain regulations, and that the food all the time is rotting in the storerooms. I was furious, for example, when I heard that our soldiers were forbidden to purchase anything they liked in the French shops. The mighty intellects which conceive measures of this kind are obviously incapable of putting themselves in the place of the soldier who wants to send a little parcel home, a few pairs of stockings, a bit of chocolate, etc., or to appreciate the tremendous joy such a parcel gives in the family. It required Goering's personal intervention to get this stupid rule canceled. As regards fruits and vegetables, Forster said he had authorized direct sale from producer to consumer with the object of preventing the deterioration of perishable goods while passing through the hands of middlemen. Forster thought, for example, that it was ridiculous to try to stop people with threats from buying asparagus and strawberries direct from the producer. These criticisms aimed at the inadequacy of the measures introduced by the Ministry of Food met with general agreement, and the Führer declared that they were well-founded. The gentlemen in the ministry must be made to understand that this nonsense has got to stop. Such inept conceptions are simply the result of stubborn concentration on the conditions obtaining in North German big business. Surely they must see by this time that it is the manifold diversity of conditions existing in the field of food supply and distribution which themselves make it essential to restrict rules of universal applications to an absolute minimum. Dr. Goebbels expressed the fear that, from the Berlin point of view, the workman might well be placed at a disadvantage by an unrestricted authorization of direct purchase by a consumer from producer. The effect might be that the wealthy would send their servants, and the idle would go themselves into the country and buy up all the fruit and vegetables, while the Berlin workman would then find nothing to buy in the fruit and vegetable stalls of the local market. Replying to a question by the Führer, Bormann said that direct purchase was being controlled by the Gauleiters according to local conditions. In certain West German territories, for example, and in Munchmann's area, it was forbidden. The Führer concluded, "It is essential that the continual carting to and fro of fruit and vegetables, with the great loss of perishable goods which ensues, must be stopped. The transportation of potatoes, too, hither and thither all over Germany, as Speer recently proved to me with voluminous graphs, is sheer idiocy. Speer further told me that beer and cigarettes were also being carted about in the same aimless fashion. This chaos must also come to an end. It is nonsense that cigarettes manufactured in Dresden should be sent to Berlin for distribution, and that then a portion of them, representing the ration for Saxony, should solemnly be sent back to Dresden. We cannot afford the luxury of such futilities. We must approach this problem of the transportation of supplies with strict logic. Such produce as is not required for local consumption must be sent to the nearest district in which there is a deficiency in these particular goods. industrial towns must be assured of their supplies by help from the neighboring countryside. We must encourage the setting up of big concerns, for not only are they easier to supervise, but they will also produce many times the volume that would be produced by a number of minor undertakings occupying the same amount of ground. We must further ensure a more methodical utilization of foodstuffs in the great cities by increasing in them the number of canteens for workers and employees and the number of public kitchens. This will enable the citizens to have a decent meal two or three times a week and at the same time save ration coupons. The overriding principle must be that everything in the way of agricultural produce that is grown in the territories under German control must be at the disposal of the consumer. If, for example, eggs go bad in the Ukraine for lack of means of transportation, then we must use the immense reserves of straw held in that country for the manufacture of additional fuel for gas-burning forms of transportation, which would help solve the problem. As Speer rightly said, if we stop carting beer uselessly about the country, we shall have ample refrigerator wagons for other purposes.
Well, that was really good, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's getting right down to the details.
And, right.
I thought one of the most interesting comments, Carolyn, was where he says here, well, yeah, the gentleman in the ministry must be made to understand that this nonsense has got to stop. And surely they must see by this time that it is the manifold diversity of conditions existing in the field of food supply and distribution which themselves make it essential to restrict rules of universal application to an absolute minimum. And, you know, rules of universal application, well, we make a law here in Berlin, it's got to apply to every city in Germany and all this stuff, was ridiculous because, as Hitler quite accurately points out here, conditions are different in different parts of the country, and there, you know, the produce varies and things like this. So universal rules that some bureaucrat decides to, okay, we're going to put some order to this and make a universal law, are actually a huge detriment to efficiency. And I think that's what he was pointing out there.
Yes. And this is the one I was mentioning earlier. It's not exactly what you were saying. But after Dr. Gill's speech, he then talks about the perishables being transported all around and back and forth from here to there, and while they're deteriorating in quality. And Speer actually did a study on all this. That Speer, even though he turned so rotten after the war and during the Nuremberg time, and ever since, he was really an asset, and he was such a smart guy, and he just grasped the big picture of things. And Hitler is saying how Speer did a study on that and proved to them that this was wrong. It was idiotic, and they were carting stuff from one place and then sending it back to where it came from, a portion of it, you know. And that reminded me of, I said, this is the same as the United States federal government collecting taxes and then, from the states and then solemnly sending back a portion of it. Mm-hmm. To those states, instead of deciding what should go to the federal government, leaving the rest for the states to deal with. No, they took it all. And then they said, well, we'll send you back what is your portion. Stupid. And that's pretty much the idea. This was even worse, though, in Germany with the perishable things, to do it that way. Well, I guess you talked about the rest of it. So they were getting eggs from the Ukraine. They were getting a lot of good food from the Ukraine. During that time, that was a very productive place.
Sure.
It could be. And they were making it more productive. They were going to make it even more productive. It's quite the food supplies,
it was referred to as the bread basket of
Yeah, the
of
bread
Europe
basket. Yeah, but bread was big at that time. They ate tons of bread. They didn't seem to do, it seemed to, as long as the bread was good quality bread, it seemed to be nourishing for them. I'm not a big bread fan, but then I know Germans always ate a lot of bread, and so did most Europeans. So, and as Hitler says, the Romans' army traveled on bread and grains. That's what they had. you know, and they were certainly capable and strong enough for it. Well, these kind of things I think are very interesting, and it's nice to know what they were saying about it. And it shows how the idea was always what was best for the people in the country, not how to take advantage of, you know, and make people serve you and worship you and so on. They weren't doing anything like that. They were really working for the people.
Just as an aside here, I wanted to ask you, and I thought of what you might have been thinking when you read this, because it perplexes me a bit, and I want to see if you what you think about what he's talking about here. And it's not the Fuhrer. It's where, I guess, Bormann has written this, where it says Dr. Goebbels said the Fuhrer's idea of making
the
state...
that's Picker now, Ray. That's Picker, the guy who's taking the notes, who's...
Not the translator.
The note taker at the time there, and where this crowd was, where Hitler at the dinner table. Yeah, it's currently Picker, Dr. Picker doing it.
Yeah, Dr. Goebbels said the Fuhrer's idea of making the state step in as a subsidiary purchaser was a solution after the manner of Columbus and the egg. Now, I'd looked at that, Columbus and the egg. What's he talking about there? Was it Christopher Columbus and something about did the egg or the chicken come first or what? I'm way off base, but I couldn't make, I couldn't translate that into something.
Well, you know, I didn't look it up. I didn't know either, and I didn't look it up. I can do it right now,
though. I don't
know
that we could have even looked it up, but...
Well, you
but
can always Google everything. Columbus and the egg. Let's see what I come up with here. Egg of Columbus. It's on Wikipedia. Columbus breaking the egg. Let's see. An egg of Columbus or Columbus's egg refers to a brilliant idea or discovery that seems simple or easy after the fact. Oh, yeah. You know.
Okay. Yeah.
So there you go.
Well, good deal. Good deal.
And
I appreciate
so there is some
that.
Idea that this relates to something about Columbus, but something that he did. He challenged his critics to make an egg stand, on its tip, and they gave up. And I don't know. Anyway, but
okay. Well, now I know the reference.
Right.
Very good.
And me too. It only took a second, so it was easy to find out.
There you go. 24th June, 1942, at dinner.
I've got some timeline. Okay, the 25th of June, 1942, General Dwight D. Eisenhower arrives in London, ready to assume the post of commander of American forces in Europe. Now, I know this is the 24th you're going to read, but then it jumps to something else, so I thought I'd put there's only something on the 25th, so I thought I'd put it here. It's the day after this day that they're talking here. And another one, so Eisenhower arrives in London. And on the 25th also, there's another massive 1,000-bomber raid, this time on Bremen. But it says the raiders suffered grievous losses. Well, that was when, in the beginning, they had excellent anti-aircraft on the ground, and these British planes weren't prepared for it. But they got better and better with radar and destroying that and being surprise attacks and so on. So, but in the beginning, they were having tremendous losses, the planes.
Oh, yeah, I know. A lot of that attributable to the many German fighters that went up to meet them. And those, of course... the number of fighters available to Germany kept dropping and dropping because of attrition.
That was a big part of it. So then later on, they didn't have any fighters there, nearly enough
to
do it. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. 24th June, 1942 at dinner. The right man in the right place. The choice of leaders. A free hand for regional chiefs. Decentralization and unity, choice of the head of the state, emperors by election. From the time I started to organize the party, I made it a rule never to fill an appointment until I had found the right man for it. I applied this principle to the post of Berlin Gauleiter. even when the older members of the party bombarded me with complaints over the party leadership in Berlin, I refrained from coming to their assistance until I could promise them that in Dr. Goebbels I had found the man I was seeking. For Dr. Goebbels possesses two attributes without which no one could master the conditions in Berlin. He has an intelligence and the gift of oratory. Further, he's a typical son of the Ruhr, that type which, thanks to its close ties with the iron and steel processes, gives us a man of exceptional value and merit. When I invited Goebbels to study the organization of the party in Berlin, he reported in due course that the weakness lay in the junior leaders, and he asked me for a free hand to make the necessary changes and purge the party of all unsatisfactory elements. I have never regretted giving him the powers he asked for. When he started, he found nothing particularly efficient as a political organization to help him. Nevertheless, in the literal sense of the word, he captured Berlin. He worked like an ox, regardless of all the stresses and strains to which the latent opposition of people like Stennis must have exposed him. It is no longer possible today to insist on the same corps d'élite as leaders of the party as we were able to find during the years of struggle, a Kampfzeit. For in those days, veritable idealists rushed forward, fanatically determined to give their all for the idea. Reichsleiter Bormann is quite right when he mentions Major Dinklage in this respect, the rucksack major, as he was called. Night and day, Dinklage was on the road speaking and recruiting for the National Socialist German Workers' Party. When he got home, he stayed there for just so long as was needed to pack a little food in his rucksack, and off he went again. And he was typical of very many at the time. Whenever I ponder over the question of selection of leaders, I often recall what happened in East Prussia. As long as the party leadership in East Prussia remained in the hands of some nincompoop, the local landowners declared themselves with vigor in favor of the party, for they regarded these men of ours as mere jacks in office who could easily be swept away when the time came for them to take power into their own hands. But when I put Cook on their backs as Gauleiter, and they soon realized that was a very different proposition, for then they immediately joined the camp of the opponents of the NSDAP. The experience I gained while organizing the party during the Kampfzeit will stand me in good stead now that I have the organization of the Reich in my hands. If at the time I made the Gauleiters into kings of their Gaul, who received from above only the broadest possible instructions, I now intend to give to our Reichsstatthalter the same wide freedom, even if this should sometimes bring me into conflict with the Ministry of the Interior. It is only by giving the Gauleiter and the Reichsstatthalter a free hand that one finds out where real capability lies. Otherwise, there will eventually spring up a stolid, stupid bureaucracy. It is only by giving the regional leaders responsibility that one will obtain men eager to accept it, and thus form a nucleus from which to choose the leaders for the highest post in the state. While giving my Gauleiters and Reichsstatthalters the greatest possible liberty of action, I have at the same time demanded of them the strictest possible discipline in obedience to orders from above, it being understood, of course, that the central government is not concerned with matters of detail, which vary greatly in different parts of the country. In this connection, I want to lay particular emphasis on one point, namely, that there is nothing more harmful to the organization of a state than over-centralization and limitation of local power. The lawyers among us hanker constantly for such limitation, but as Bismarck rightly pointed out in 1871, it was centralization that had brought about the downfall of France. The petty departments, being vested with no powers at all, were robbed of all initiative and sat dumbly awaiting instructions from Paris. I can sum up my own views by saying that one should give to local authority the widest possible powers of self-government, but should at the same time ensure strict obedience to orders from above. Wherever superior authority intervenes, its orders must be regarded as final. Side by side with the integrated legislative body must stand the executive as the firmly established instrument of the national will, and this executive, with the Wehrmacht at its head, then the police, the labor organization, the youth education, etc., must be in the control of one single man. Together, these two, legislative body and executive, form the cement that binds the state into a single corporate entity. The state, which succeeds in achieving this, has nothing to fear. The greatest danger occurs when the executive possesses at the same time supreme legislative powers or aspires to them. This leads inevitably to those rivalries between component units of the Wehrmacht, between provinces and so on, which in the past have caused the downfall of a number of most healthy states. As regards the head of the state, should anything happen to me, it would be as unsound to elect my successor by public vote as it would for, say, the Pope to be elected by suffrage among the faithful, or the Doge of Venice by the vote of the whole population of the city. If the mass of the people were invited to take part in such a vote, the whole thing would degenerate into a propaganda battle, and the propaganda for or against any candidate would tear the people asunder. If the choice is left to a small body, a Senate, for instance, and marked differences of opinion should arise in it, I don't think it would matter very much, provided that no hint of these differences was allowed to become public. But once the votes have been cast, then he who receives the majority becomes automatically and forthwith the supreme head of the state. If it is further arranged that the oath of allegiance to the new head can be administered to the Wehrmacht, the party, and all the appropriate officials within 3 hours of the result of the election, then maintenance of public law and order can be regarded as assured. I have no illusions, however, that an absolutely outstanding personality will always emerge by this method of selection, but it does at least ensure that the man chosen will be one so much above the average that as long as the machinery of government is in good order, the state will not be endangered in any way. The old German method of electing the emperor was an ideal way of forming a government. It unfortunately broke down, however, because the princely electors were themselves hereditary princes in their own right. As Germany had for centuries been the incarnation of the Western world without ever being seriously menaced from outside, these hereditary sovereigns, preoccupied primarily with the domestic affairs of their own states, considered that they could afford to have the luxury of a weak emperor, and consequently a minimum of interference from the center in their own affairs. It must therefore be an absolute and fundamental principle of National Socialism that office in neither Gau, state, nor party is hereditary. Each Gauleiter, I consider, should have a deputy. The danger that the latter might intrigue against his chief is precluded by the party rule that no deputy may succeed his chief as Gauleiter in the Gau in which he has officiated as deputy. In this way, we National Socialists guard ourselves against a stab in the back. A deputy Gauleiter can, of course, aspire to promotion as Gauleiter of a different province, always provided that he has never intrigued to bring about the downfall of his own chief. The criterion for judging the qualities of a deputy Gauleiter is the degree of prosperity in the Gau, for when all is going well in the Gau, it is not due solely to the work and the personality of the Gauleiter, but to those of his deputy as well, who also has definite tasks of his own. As a sure safeguard against the Gau's ever becoming a hereditary post, I have adopted a system of transfer applicable to those Gauleiters who have not, of their own efforts, succeeded in winning over their Gau to National Socialism. For example, I have transferred the Gauleiter of Salzburg to Styria and have replaced him in Salzburg by a member of the party who up till now had been doing work of a totally different kind.
See, I think that Styria should be Styria. Because Styria is in Austria like Salzburg is.
It doesn't make any sense. I knew it was a misprint, but I didn't write it down.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I would never send to a town like Vienna a man of whom I have high expectations later on in other spheres of activity. In short, there will never be any question of son succeeding father. Can you see me appointing some youngster of 17 as chief of the general staff? Bormann interposed that normally the son of a mathematics professor was not inclined to follow in father's footsteps. The Fuhrer concluded, well, that's not surprising. As a general rule, a son inherits the characteristics of his mother and not those of his father. I know of the son of an industrialist who refused at any price to go into his father's business, having inherited the idealism of his mother, who had been divorced and remarried. He decided to become a soldier and a parachutist into the bargain. Oh, good stuff there. Very good.
Boy, that is good, and that's really long, and there's so much there. Several topics, all related, though. So, first, though, it's basically he's talking about leadership and the kind of people he wants. That's basically what he's talking about here.
Exactly.
And he says that he praises Goebbels, saying he has two attributes which stand out for him, his intelligence and the gift of oratory.
Oratory,
and,
uh-huh.
Yeah, and that... he sees him as a very strong person who's a son of the Ruhr, the industrial part of the country, industrial part on the western side, anyway. And then he talks about Goebbels being the perfect Gauleiter for Berlin. Oh, now this is interesting about East Prussia. He said it's an area of the large landowners. That's always been where a lot of the nobility are, or maybe not that,
yes.
But aristocrats, the Vons, so-and-sos, and the Grafs and so on, mostly the Vons up there. And they have large land holdings. And we've talked about them, how they like to get along with other people of their own type rather than other Germans. They look down on Germans. They didn't have the kind of sense of being a German that Hitler would have wanted them to have. And he said that they went along with the party as long as they thought that the guy in representing the party there, the Gauleiter, was weak. But when he put Koch in as Gauleiter, who was known to be a very tough guy who's also got a very bad reputation, in the mainstream for being an evil, horrible, one of the worst Nazis of all, and a murderer and so on, but he put him in there. And they realized they had a different person there, and so much so that they even left the party. And Hitler was always saying that he didn't mind people like that leaving the party because he didn't want them in the party anyway. Let's see, what else? Now, the Reichsstatthalters is another Reichsstatthalter translates as Reich Lieutenant or Reich Governor. And I got the impression that it once had a different meaning back in history, more. But currently, it was like the newly added territories that were a part of the Reich, and they'd have a Reich governor there. So, but they weren't exactly a Gau, because they weren't they were new. I don't know how that works, actually. But that's what he's talking about. They're both leaders of Reich territories, and he wants to give them more freedom and more liberty of action, he says.
Exactly.
And you like that.
This is the part where I said at the start of the show, Carolyn, that there were a couple of statements in here that really hit home with me about my background in studying American history, the founding of the country, the Constitution, things like this, that really hit close. And one of those was the statement where where he says that there is nothing more harmful to the organization of a state than over-centralization and limitation of local power. And when the Constitutional Convention was held in American history to come up with some sort of ruling or set of rules and government, forming a central government versus the state governments and things, that was the primary consideration, that the central government's power was going to be very limited, and that local authority and local power was going to be of primal importance.
Right.
And he says right here, and that's the Articles of Confederation, which were our initial rules of government in this country, that's how they were set up. And so, and then one other statement, this so resounded to me about our senators, how senators were sent to the nation's capital initially. They were not voted in. They were selected by a state's ruling elite, if you will, the governor, the officers of the state, people who carried clout in business and whatever. They would get together and pick someone to be a senator from the state and send them forward to Washington, D.C. There was no direct election of senators until the amendment came to do that. And as, exactly as he says here, should anything happen to me, it would be very unsound to elect my successor by public vote, because if the mass of the people are invited to take part in such a vote, the whole thing would degenerate into a propaganda battle. And of course, that's exactly what has happened since they overturned that, and the senators are no longer appointed, but they are elected, and it's turned into a parliamentary sham. But that's what that reminded me of, direct election of senators, which has gone against what the Founding Fathers set up, and which is much weaker because of it.
Yeah, I thought that it would turn into a propaganda play or whatever he called it. I can't find that part right now.
Yeah,
but I had that. I thought that was really important, because that's exactly what it does and what it has done. And that's what democracy is. It's just a way it leads to, and then they think that a system like Hitler had is all, you just propagandize the people, tell them what you want. They don't have any way to hear anything different. Well, that's true. Mm-hmm. But basically that's true. But when you have democracy, it doesn't change anything. You're still government by propaganda, by whoever is the strongest and comes out ahead. So, and now they work together. So all we have here in the United States is two parties, and they just work together. They don't really try to bring about different ideas or a different way of doing things. So it's even worse, because at least in the one, you know where the information is coming from. It's coming from the Fuhrer. But here you're told that, it's just coming from the press and all these different voices who have to speak out and say what they want, and then we have to let that work itself to what's best. Nothing like that. Yeah, and then I thought it was good where he said that brought out France, saying that that was what caused the downfall of France was the centralization, and leaving the petty departments being vested with no powers at all, just sitting around in their offices
waiting for orders from Paris.
Right.
Yeah,
you know,
very good.
I thought that was very, very good. Let's see. Okay. Well, I don't want to skip anything here, because it's so very good. It goes on and on, doesn't it? Oh, and then talking about how to elect his successor, and he's talked about that before. He wants a special. Once it went into a lot of detail. He wanted a special committee that was designed to do that, and then there would be some kind of check and balance on what they were doing, sort of. I thought it was good that he made it very clear that a son should never succeed to his father's job, and particularly as the leader of Germany, you should never allow the son to be next in line. He hated everything hereditary. You know, that comes out very much here, that That's why he didn't think the monarchies worked because of that. And the quality of person that you need. Look now at this Prince Andrew thing. Of course, he's not the one who's going to be king, but still, these people in these royal families, there's just a lot of really bad news people in there who are just worthless. So
Oh, I was just going to say, you have so many of the very best in your citizenry that aren't allowed to be a part of taking advantage of their talents and running the state and helping to do what's best for the country. They're out because they're blood lineage. So.
Yeah. And he says, there will never be any question of a son succeeding father. Never. He's just totally against that because they're not, often they're too young anyway when the father dies. The son is too young, you're the next in line. And he thinks that's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, he had defined that about two paragraphs above it when he said it must therefore be an absolute and fundamental principle of National Socialism that office in neither Gaul, state, or party is hereditary. So,
right.
Yeah, that's a fundamental principle that can't be violated. So, anyway, well done.
Yeah, very good. And I've got a timeline for the 26th and the 27th, okay. And this is for this. What you're going to read is the 27th. It's very short. The 26th, the Germans drive toward Rostov on Don. That's on the Eastern Front in Russia. And on the 27th, convoy PQ-17 set sail from Iceland, and only 11 of 37 ships will survive. Now, that's pretty interesting that they were they took off, and it was mainly a bunch of British ships and other stuff, and a big convoy, 37 ships and whatever else they had with them. But I guess they were decimated by the German submarines, but it sounded like there were some German ships, too. I read some on it, but we don't have time to talk about that anyway, so let's go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, 27th of June, 1942, at dinner. De Grelle asserts, magnificent behavior of the Flamands. The three phases of the fate of Belgium and Holland. Roman roads and viaducts. Our road network in the east. Tobruk, a happy omen. Churchill and Roosevelt confer. Britain in the toils. The Reich press chief, Dr. Dietrich, invited the attention of the Führer to a complaint made by de Grelle, the Belgian royalist leader, at present serving as a legionary on the Eastern Front, to the effect that in the recent exchanges of prisoners of war, there were never any Rexists among the Belgians so exchanged. The Belgian members of the exchange committee were, de Grelle maintained, out-and-out reactionaries who persistently ignored the existence of the Rexists. The Führer replied, I direct that steps be immediately taken to ensure that de Grelle has the decisive vote in the selection of Belgian prisoners to be liberated. It goes without saying that those who are risking their lives for the Europe of tomorrow have prior claim to a sympathetic hearing in Germany. Let me add that I think we have acted far too leniently towards the Belgian reactionaries. It was a mistake not to have made King Leopold a prisoner, and out of consideration for his Italian friends who pleaded for him, to have allowed him to live in Belgium. For while this Belgian king is no intellectual luminary, he has an infinite capacity for intrigue and is the center of attraction for all reactionaries.
See, now there's those Italians again, you know, making mistakes. Because how many times has Hitler talked about the Italian court people? That's probably who they are, you know, who were friends with all the other royalty and so on. That's where their allegiance lay, with members of their own aristocracy. Yeah.
Yeah, he had mentioned in one of our previous lessons that we had about how they kind of had the Duce hamstrung, you know, or that he unfortunately deferred to those people. And, you know, and Hitler felt real bad about that for, you know, felt like Duce was remiss in not being extremely forceful with those people.
Right.
As a counterweight to these reactionary elements, we have the magnificent conduct of the Flemish on the Eastern Front. The Flamands, F-L-A-M-A-N-D-S, have indeed shown themselves on the Eastern Front to be more pro-German and more ruthless than the Dutch Legionnaires. This is certainly due to the fact that the Flemish have for centuries been oppressed by the Walloons. The lack of harmony between the Flamands and the Walloons has not escaped the notice of the Duce. When he speaks of the Europe of the future, he is wont to group the Flemish and the Dutch on one side and the Walloons and the French on the other. As regards the status of the Walloons, I am inclined to think that the Duce is not quite correct in his appreciation of the problem of northwestern Europe. The solution which he is inclined to dangle before the eyes of the small minority of Walloons is hardly practicable but within the framework of the greater Germanic state, das Großgermanische Reich. I am pleased, therefore, that there exists neither in Holland nor in Belgium any government with which we should have to negotiate. This will enable us to impose whatever we feel is politically expedient and obviously useful. I propose solving the problems of these small states by means of brief and decisive declarations. Now, the next paragraph starts a different subject, so I just thought we, if we wanted to comment any on what's been said here. The only thing I had to mention was if any of our listeners are not that familiar with Leon de Grelle and his Rexist party in Belgium was very, very pro-national socialist, very, very dedicated to stopping the Soviet advance towards Europe. And there wasn't a finer soldier anywhere than de Grelle. And he and his Rexist were mentioned at the start of this paragraph here. He says, hey, you know, in the exchange of prisoners, none of my Rexists are ever the ones allowed, you know, to be exchanged. It's only these reactionaries, the Belgian reactionaries, and that stirred Hitler's anger, you know, and he said that let's give de Grelle the final say-so in who gets exchanged. So that's what that was. That's about all I had to say about that.
Okay.
Now, the beginnings of every civilization express themselves in terms of road construction. Under the direction of Caesar, and during the first two centuries of the Germanic era, it was by means of the construction of roads and tracks that the Romans reclaimed the marshlands and blazed trails through the forests of Germania. Following their example, our first task in Russia will be to construct roads. To start off with the construction of railways would be to put the cart before the horse. In my opinion, the construction of at least 750 to 1,000 miles of thoroughfare is required on military grounds alone. For unless we have unexceptional roads at our disposal, we shall not be able to either mop up militarily the vast Russian spaces or make them permanently secure. Such labor in the Russian towns and villages as is not required for agriculture and the arms industry must therefore forthwith be put on to road construction. When we start choosing the sites for new villages in Russia, we must not confine ourselves to purely military expediency, but must choose with a view to breaking the monotony of the vast open roads. And that's kind of self-explanatory. Then the subject changes again here. The capture of Tobruk is a victory as great as it was inconceivable. And at the moment, it comes as a real stroke of fortune for the German people. With the same effect that Japan's entry into the war burst upon us in a critical moment of the Eastern struggle, so Rommel's victory over the British African Expeditionary Force explodes in the midst of the Spanish intrigues. To give you some idea of these intrigues, let me merely tell you that the Spanish Minister for Foreign Affairs, Suñer, has just allowed himself to be honored, if you please, by the Pope with the gift of a rosary. That the negotiations between Churchill and Roosevelt continued for 8 whole days must not be attributed, however, solely to the fact that Rommel has decisively shattered Britain's position in the Mediterranean. When two people are in general agreement, decisions are swiftly taken. My own conversations with the Duce have never lasted more than an hour and a half, the rest of the time being devoted to ceremonies of various kinds. The only time that our conversations lasted for nearly 2 days was when things were going badly in Albania, and I had to try to restore the Duce's morale. It is easy, therefore, by comparison, to imagine how enormous their difficulties must appear to the Allies. Apart from that, to harness to a common purpose a coalition composed of Great Britain, United States, Russia, and China demands little short of a miracle. If, for instance, Litvinov is constantly invited to attend conversations between Churchill and Roosevelt, it is obviously because Russia holds a most potent trump card against Britain as regards India. Now that Britain has lost the Far East, there is no danger more pressing for her than the possibility that Russia, should the relations between the two countries deteriorate, might well seek compensation for her losses in Europe at the expense of India. I think it may well be this option which they hold on India that is causing Russia to avoid at all costs a state of war with Japan. That need not worry us, for the very fact that a state of non-belligerence exists between Russia and Japan strengthens our hand vis-a-vis India in the game we have to play against Britain. By far, the most interesting problem of the moment is, what is Britain going to do now? She has already made herself look ridiculous in the eyes of the world by declaring war when quite inadequately armed for war, and it's unlikely that she will perform any miracle at this juncture. At the moment, the British are trying to wiggle out of their difficulties by spreading the most varied and contradictory of rumors. To find out what she really intends to do is the task of the Wilhelmstrasse. The best way of accomplishing it would be by means of a little flirtation with Churchill's daughter, but our Foreign Office, and particularly its gentlemanly diplomats, consider such methods beneath their dignity, and they are not prepared to make this agreeable sacrifice, even though success might well save the lives of numberless German officers and men. Wow, good stuff there.
Who was Churchill's daughter? Why am I drawing a blank there? She should be well known.
You know, I don't know who she was, but if, of course, what he was obviously referring to there is maybe she, that daughter of his, might reveal within some offhand remark something that would be valuable for Germany in the conflict. But that kind of espionage, as he said, blue noses or whatever felt like it was beneath their dignity to conduct something like that. But what was most fascinating about this whole thing to me, I've always wondered, I was always irked at Japan for not engaging Russia in the east to take pressure off of German forces in the west, on the Germany's eastern front against Russia. And I thought, that's really crazy that they kind of stayed out of that fight until I saw this, and it started making sense to me because, as Hitler describes it here, Britain was walking on eggshells regarding Russia, and Russia had some losses, to the German forces and territory, and they could always say, hey, Britain, you got to help us here get this back. Because if we're going to lose territory there, we just might decide that India might make a good province of Russia. The British were, he says right here, of course, that they were very concerned regarding India. And then Hitler says the very fact that a state of non-belligerence exists between Russia and Japan strengthens our hand vis-a-vis India in the game that we have to play against Britain. So to me, it kind of explained why Hitler didn't give top priority and pushed Japan to attack Russia. So, I don't know, it just helped make a little more sense.
Churchill's daughter, he did have a daughter, her name was Mary. I guess she married, her married name maybe was Mary Soames, and she was his youngest of five children, and she lived until she was 91. Anyway, I never heard of her, but there she is. Now, let's see what else is in here. What else do you want to say about this? This business about the Walloons and the
the Flemish.
Yeah, the Flemish have always been good and the best best people over there. And the Dutch are sometimes good, sometimes not. And I thought it was I just thought it was really interesting that he went along with what some people wanted and allowed King Leopold to remain in his country. They should have made him a prisoner, they said, but they allowed him to remain as king of the country. Didn't help anything at all. He said he was a center of intrigue and attracted all the reactionaries. Yeah, the Walloons. The Walloons have always been the not so much on our side.
Right.
And
they're
more the French.
More akin to the French. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And are these the ones in Belgium? Flemish.
Yes.
Flemish Belgium.
That's
okay.
Flemish
well, then,
and the Walloons, yeah.
Yeah, the Flemish are connected with the Germans. With the Germans.
Yes.
And part of Belgium and the Walloons with the French part. Yeah. There's a lot of good people even today, really good National Socialists who live there and are considered the Flemish.
The heritage of the Rexists, and which is something to be proud of. And then you mentioned those Spanish intrigues there, and that was always a fly in the ointment as well. You know, that's Spain decided to remain neutral, not get in the fight. And a lot of that was because of the power of the Catholic Church and, for lack of a better, the Jewish hold on Spain. And, it was just disappointing to me that Franco, the Spanish Civil War in 1937 or so, I think the only reason that Franco came out on top of that, that the Reds didn't topple him, was because of the help he got from Germany. And,
yeah.
We're
going to have to go, Ray. We've got we're ending up on time, so that's good. And this has been Table Talk, episode 41, on January 8th, 2015. Good night, everyone.
Good night, folks. Join us next week. Bye-bye.